Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening. I'm Andrew Farrago, gallery manager of the Cartoon Art Museum of San Francisco. And I welcome you to this meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, by and for young people who share an interest and passion for civic issues. And tonight, I'm pleased to be joined by Scott McLeod and Rory Root. Scott has been writing and drawing comics since 1984. His book, Understanding Comics, was a New York Times notable book for 1994 and is available in 16 languages. Sin City creator Frank Miller called him just about the smartest guy in comics. And his new book, Making Comics, explores the art and craft of telling stories visually. We also have Rory Root, owner of Berkeley comic bookstore, Comic Relief. Rory's store, which has been in the Bay Area for over 20 years, has been called the mecca for Bay Area comic book fans by the San Francisco Bay Guardian. Rory has been a fixture in the comic book industry in the Bay Area and abroad, and is well known for supporting a wide variety of comics publications and outreaching to other book buyers, such as librarians. Please give a warm welcome for Scott and Rory. Okay, so let's get started by discussing your backgrounds. So if you can just talk a little bit about yourself and your career in the comics industry, and we'll get started with Scott here.
Well, as you mentioned, I started in 84, but I decided I was going to make comics back in 74, so I was about 14 years old. I think that my career, although I began writing and drawing fiction, I very quickly morphed into a sort of cartoonist commentator. I don't really know how to describe myself, but I'm very interested in how comics work. I'm very much a formalist. I want to take comics apart and put them back together, and as such, I've written these series of books about how the medium works and how to make it work for you. Recently, though, I felt that I need to write the balance a little bit, and so I'm working right now on a graphic novel, almost entirely in my head, because my family and I have been on tour to all 50 states, so I've been putting off actually putting pen to paper. But as soon as I get home in a couple of weeks, I'm going to begin working on this thing, and it's probably going to run to 300 or 400 pages. So I'm very interested. Now that I've taken comics apart and seen how they work, I'd like to put all the pieces back together and maybe hide my tricks and just tell a story for a change. So that's where I'm at.
Great. And Rory, can you tell us a little bit about the road that led you to become the head of the mecca for Bay Area comic fans?
You don't have to bow five times a day. Just come once a week, bring your wallet. By about 74, I'd been too old for comics for about 2 years now. Went off the Cal in 75, discovered the underground comics, Asterix, Tintin, Metal Hurlant, and sort of had a small affair with comics for a couple of months there, and put it aside, thought I was done. And dropping out of Cal, I ended up working at a game store, something I really loved, really enjoyed. And one day, the game store partnership broke up, and I ended up taking a job at a comic shop for a week or two before I went back to Cal. I went up the street to my favorite science fiction bookstore, The Change of Hobbit, and while there, Tom Whitmore, one of the partners, looked at me and said, "Is the new Eisner Quarterly in yet?" And I went, "Who?" He shook his head. "Rory, you cannot work in the comic book store and not know who Will Eisner is." Reached behind himself, pulled out a copy of Contract with God, and said, "Here, first one's free, kid." I don't know whether to thank him or damn him, but more than 30 years later, I'm still doing this. Eisner's name is a name that'll come up probably fairly frequently. Opened Comic Relief in 87 to run a comic store the way I sort of thought it should be. We joined the American Booksellers Association that same year. A number of comic store owners around thought we were putting on airs to do so. When I tried to apply to their prospective bookseller school to learn how to do the bookstore a little bit better, they told me, "No, you already run a bookstore." I went, yeah, right, we do. We were the first winner of the Will Eisner, told you his name had come up again, Spirit of Comics Retailing Award, which is sort of a Hall of Fame for retailers. And I knew we'd won the minute they said books in the introduction. My partner at the time, Mike Patchen, thought I was a bit precipitous. And at that point, pretty much the only bookstore in comics was mine. Bud Plant did wonderful mail order work. There were other people who had specialty fields, but in terms of a generalist bookstore for comics, we were pretty much the only game in town. Luckily, that's no longer true at all. The book format makes comics accessible to wider audiences. And that's one of the missions. That and getting comics for adults, which at the time seemed to be rare on the ground, were sort of the two initial mission statements Comicly started out with.
Okay, and before we get too far along, we should address the topic of the evening, which is graphic novels. So I assume everyone in the audience knows what a comic book is or thinks they know what a comic book is. So what exactly separates that from, again, the topic of the evening, graphic novels?
Well, in terms of format, a graphic novel is just a big, fat comic book. But when we use the term, we're implying something more, at least some aspiration towards something like the literary aspirations of novels and the density of a good novel. Something that's a little bit challenging, that's a little complex, that takes more than 20 minutes to read. And it's funny because the term had been kicking around for some time before I think the movement really got into high gear. And it was works like Mouse by Art Spiegelman or Chris Ware's Jimmy Corrigan that did challenge us to that degree. And it was, in the end, I think the movement was really energized by works of that sort. But by then there had been hundreds of things claiming to be graphic novels. Some companies had taken various issues of superhero comics and just slapped them together. But, you know, Astonishing X-Men 243 through 247 or whatever, just, you know, if you pick enough issues, maybe it adds up to 200 or 300 pages, but it is not a graphic novel. It takes authors with the intent to create something that's self-contained, that is challenging, that talks to itself on the shelf at night when nobody's looking, you know, where all of the parts reflect the whole, those sorts of qualities. And fortunately now, we have enough to fill a few shelves, and we have that beachhead, that canon, that list of worthwhile graphic novels from which we can begin to build something really lasting.
Okay, I guess I do disagree a bit.
We're talking
in agreement about when we get there. Graphic novel, in terms of general usage, in terms of librarians and booksellers across the country, just means any comic format with a spine. Mm. Now, what Scott talks about is how graphic novels started out. That's what the aspiring to the great American graphic novel was certainly a large part of a lot of creative talent's search for some meaning in their art form. That first graphic novel I mentioned, Contract of God, well, not really a novel, being four short novellas by Will Eisner. And the word graphic has gotten some people confused as to whether we're selling pornography or whether we're, you know, graphic violence or what it is that we actually mean with graphic novel. But just like movies are not so special because they move, and we got rid of the talkies thing pretty quick, comic books are comic books, and they're not always funny. And graphic novels, to the general public and to the general book-selling trade, means any comic book is fine, whether it's X-Men 137 to, rather, 129 to 137, or which can be a complete story. In this case, it's the Death of Phoenix Saga, which was probably the best-selling graphic novel in America for years and years and years. But actually, the book format changed the way, the graphic novel changed the way a number of creators actually looked at their own work. I've talked to a number of creators who, in the process of collecting their own books, made the very silly mistake of stopping at issue 5, because that's what their other friends were doing when their story stopped at 6 or 7. And some of them had to go through some conniption fits to resize and put it back into a more natural story break format. At the same point, some creators now working in the Marvel and DC superhero world and other worlds of comics are very much writing for a trade paperback by padding the issues or by cutting short storylines that they should have pursued further. Like any tool, it can have positive and negative uses.
Yeah, it's true.
I don't know that we necessarily disagree, though, about the meaning, because what we've really done is we've described the two different meanings of the term graphic novel in comics today. One is an industry meaning, and it is a format. It is a format with a very dynamic history and quite a varied history. But then there is the graphic novels movement that we sometimes speak of as a literary force in comics that's transforming comics. And that's, I think, another meaning, really, of the term. But they're both in common usage. It just depends on which crowd you're talking to.
I think the major thing graphic novels have brought to the American comic book is new readership. In the days gone by, you had to be there every Friday or every Tuesday, and nowadays it's every Wednesday and has been for some time. But I'm old. Older than you. What happens now with a graphic novel? You walk in this store, your friend tells me this Watchmen film's coming out, you've never heard of it, they told you it's a good book, you see on the back of it, it won a Hugo. So you buy Watchmen, and you buy all 12 issues, and you buy it in one chunk. A lot of serialized fiction has been collected up, just like Dickens' books were collected up, or some of the Sherlock Holmes stories were collected up in the graphic novel format. So I'm not so sure that there's a real difference in meaning whether you intended to have a book like Blankets at 594 pages from the beginning, or whether you wanted to do 7 or 10 or 12 issues of a comic that actually became a concrete and solid story. Mm. But the thing that graphic novels have done more than anything else, for 20 years now I've been selling comics and graphic novels in the libraries, and it was a very hard road at the beginning. As the book format became more and more accepted, the easier it was to get graphic novels in the libraries, the easier it was for that casual readership, that new readership, to discover them in libraries and not wander around going, where's issue 3? And how come issue 4 is $20? I just want to read it. The complete and total story was available. And that's the other thing, besides reading Conrad of God and finding a story for adults, but not necessarily adults only, was this is a book. This could be reordered. This could be reprinted. This is something that, as a lifelong bibliophile, I knew what this meant to comics, even if I didn't, at that point, had fallen yet in love with comics as much as I have been or am now. But I think the access to a general readership, you walk into a bookstore nowadays, and there's almost no bookstore out there other than very specialized or very small bookstores that won't have some graphic novel section. Some will have a mostly manga. Some will have, primarily works from Random House and sort of the new canon of avant-garde graphic novels. And some will have the Marvel and DC books they read when they were kids. Some attempt to do all of it. But, I mean, as an example, a few years ago at a graphic novel conference that the major distributor had, the question was asked around the room, from retailers from all over the country, how many books you had. And they asked me first, and I passed, because I didn't want to give our answer out. And the person next to me said 1,200, and every single person at that table said 1,200, except one guy I think was honest and said 900. And they got back to me, and I said 9,000. And they went, no, not how many copies you have, and isn't that too many, but how many titles? I said 9,000. I wasn't lying then, and I'm not lying now when I say Comic Relief has 20,000 titles. If you read for entertainment, if you read for information, there's probably a graphic novel out there for you. Since you're here, I suspect you guys already and gals already know that. But if you don't, if you wandered in here by mistake and should be listening to the Water Symposium next door, go to your library, go to a good independent bookstore, go to Comic Relief. And there's actually, in terms of comic stores in the Bay Area, we're larded with great stores. I mean, the Will Eisner Comics Retailer Award, the first 4 years, a Bay Area store won each year. And there's at least several stores in the area that should win or will win soon. We're lucky. And the guys who started Comics and Comics back in the day here set the bar very, very high. If you only knew CNC in its latter days, I'm sorry. But back in the early 80s, it was just the best store in the country. And anybody was going to open up a comic store, particularly in Berkeley against our flagship store, we knew we had our work cut out for ourselves. So,
okay. And speaking of Will Eisner, I was curious what either of you sees as the starting point for graphic novels in the United States. Will Eisner is, of course, the author of A Contract with God, which came out in 1978, and I was curious if you saw that as the starting point of the modern graphic novel movement.
Well, the term graphic novel showed up a little bit earlier. I don't really recall.
65.
Rory knows.
Bill Spicer's Funny Book World, I think.
Yeah. Eisner's, as was mentioned, is what we think of as kicking off the graphic novel movement here in America. Contract with God was, it's actually an anthology of four short stories, but it had a spine and it had worth. It had ambition. It had density. And it inspired a lot. Not that quickly, though, because one of the things that happens in comics as in art, other art forms is that a very powerful work can inspire readers to want to make something like it, but they don't have it the next week. You have to wait for that little generational lag time. I know that Art Spiegelman, when Mouse started to receive a lot of attention, he had hoped that that would trigger an avalanche of graphic novels. Well, the avalanche came, but there was quite a ways before that, the sound of that cry actually carried all the way to the cliffs to trigger it. And things like Jimmy Corrigan by Chris Ware were some years after Mouse. Now I think we finally see that critical mass. We're seeing good work come out so frequently now that we might almost worry that there's a bit of a glut of talent. I've noticed that we have so many talented young artists, and the likelihood that we're going to have quite a bit more, that the only problem now is we need to create more readers fast, because we have too much work out there. I think we will, though, because a lot of this work is, in fact, aimed at a mainstream audience. But the graphic novel movement, I don't know, it's hard to say exactly where it began. What we do know is that that name, Will Eisner, keeps coming up simply because he was the one who continually and courageously continued to push the notion of it, to popularize the term far beyond what I thought it was going to succeed. I honestly thought it was just our Sunday dress-up term that I didn't think anyone would actually pick up on it. But Will managed to beat that gong long enough that suddenly there were graphic novel sections in libraries and bookstores, and there were graphic novel review sections in magazines. Words, of course, are just words. In the end, we still use the word comics. And the greatest... the greatest gains in our medium have been from those who have created works that ennoble the word comics, change the meaning of the word, rather than substitute another word. But just as in movies, you can go out and see a good movie, but then you'll turn around and write an article about it in Film Comment, and then you can put on your suit and tie and go to the Motion Picture Academy. Each medium has several different layers of terminology that they use. But in the end, no matter how silly or random or arbitrary that short little two-syllable name we happen to choose for ourselves is, in the end, we'll come to understand that it has breadth and depth if the works that it describe have breadth and depth. There's only so much you can do by just slapping a new label on it.
Did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I actually agree with almost everything Scott said. I'd like to add a few things, though. As the early dawn of sort of graphic novels came across the American art form of comics, there were a lot of false starts. The publishers at Marvel and DC decided that a graphic novel must mirror the European bande dessinée that they'd seen, and so something like similar to an Asterix or Tintin format, and we got such great works as Star Rangers, and I'm not going to name names, it's not fair, but they were working to the best of their ability. But these were editorially driven constructs for the most part. There was some very good work done. But it was, again, artificial in its limit for space, for format. It was an 8.5x11 format. They thought that was the secret of the great European graphic novels, not people like Rouillet or Moebius or Inky Wallal, Hugo Pratt. No. It's 8.5x11. You saw the same thing happen a few years later when manga became very, very popular in America, and Aubrey Publisher decided that, this really tiny paperback book format, that's the secret. Yeah, that's it. there's a book written by Kurt Busiek and illustrated by Alex Ross in a beautifully painterly style called Marbles that Marvel published back in, when was that, 94?
Thereabouts, yeah.
Shortly thereafter, Marvel produced a whole lot of other books that had Mylar acetate covers similar to Marbles did. And And they were all painted, and none of them were particularly very good. It wasn't the format. It wasn't the packaging. It was the quality of the work inside. And I think one of the things I think a lot of people sort of, since almost all of us have grown up with comics all of our lives, I don't think anybody's quite old enough not to, but the comic strip is about 110, 112 years old. The comic book is about 78 years old. And the graphic novel, anywhere from 30, if you go to Contract with God, to more like 10 to 15 years old as an art form. If you go to Mouse, which might actually be a, again, started out as a serialized pamphlet, actually started out as an underground comic and something called Bakersfield Funnies, if I'm not misremembering, but Animal Funnies?
I don't remember. I thought it was Arcade.
No, Arcade was later. But again, a small underground comic that, Al, you remember? But again, it was a small underground comic, a little couple of page story there. Later on in the magazine, Raw Magazine, Art proceeded to make a pamphlet, and they were starting with issue two, and told this incredibly heart-rending story that had depth, that had resonance, that anybody with a soul could read and go, yeah, that speaks to me. And one of the things that happened after it won the Pulitzer Prize, special award, not a Pulitzer Prize. Actually, this is something that happens
like the Special
comics.
Olympics.
Well, the Hugo Award that Watchmen won, they changed the rules so comics couldn't win under that kind of category again. The World Fantasy Award, that Sandman story that Charlie Vess and Neil Gaiman did, they changed the rules there too. An awful lot of art forms, when comics started winning their awards, went, wait a minute, can't have comics in amongst us. They'll pollute the gene pool or something. So comics have their own awards. The Eisners, named after, no points for guessing, Will Eisner. The Kurtzmans, named after Harvey Kurtzman. And a number of other awards. But again, it's still a very, very young art form. Think back to when jazz was 30 years old. I'm not sure they were even calling it jazz at that point. Think back to when movies were 20, 30 years old. We're just barely scraping the surface right now. I see young people at the Alternative Press Expo at their tables, and they've got some amazing work. And right next door is somebody whose work is, well, I'm sure their mom liked it. We end up with Sturgeon's Law applying sometimes. 90% of everything is crud. Sturgeon said that in response to a reviewer complaining that 90% of science fiction was crud. Sturgeon quite agreed, but again added that 90% of everything was crud. I'd add a little addenda to that. 90% of everything isn't for you. And the book you're holding or your friend's enjoying a great deal, she may love it. He may love it. It may not be your cup of tea. I've seen so many people try to introduce their girlfriends or wives to comics by handing them Watchmen. Watchmen requires a knowledge of the memes and tropes of superhero comics. It pays off so much better if you have that knowledge. If you don't have it, it sort of almost reads like a Republic serial adventure story that it makes joke about later on. There's nonfiction, there's manga, there's literature, there's superhero stories, there's underground and erotica. If there's a story out there to be told, somebody is trying to tell it or has already told it in comic books. And I find for the casual readers, the new readers, the nonfiction section tends to be the easiest entree for them into comics. Larry Gonick's incredible cartoonist of the universe. Rick Geary's masterly period piece, murder mysteries. Persepolis by Marjan Satrapi. Just a groundbreaking work that they're now required reading at West Point Military Academy. So it seems like we'll be over in the Middle East for a while. It'd be nice if we knew a little bit more about the culture than rock-throwing revolutionaries and gray-bearded mullahs. The world of comics is very diverse. The world of comics is still figuring out what it is. But I know one thing it's not. It's not just a farm team for Hollywood. I mean, it's great when Hollywood goes and makes money. It's great when a creator gets a paycheck or an option check. After Who Framed Roger Rabbit, everybody with a funny animal book at that year's BEA got an option check ranging between $500 and $5,000. And sort of where that zero went seemed to depend on how much you hesitated to give it to them. And it was great. A lot of cartoonists probably got better paid that one check than they did for the book's entire lifetime, perhaps. But again, comics is a medium that can tell. It's not a genre. A lot of people mistake it as just superheroes. There's a number of books we brought for the reception afterwards to show you books that you may not have seen if you're fairly new to comics. There's not a superhero book in the bunch. We actually figured out at the last minute we'd not brought any and thought about bringing a couple. We didn't have any in decent quantity enough that we wanted to recommend, but we figured if you like Spider-Man or Batman or Superman, you probably already knew where to find a Spider-Man, Batman, or Superman story. And that's also led to some interesting effects from the movies when you know, there's a Spider-Man or Batman movie, when there's a Sin City or History of Violence or American Splendor movie, a very different response in terms of how we see stores in the bookstore reflect interest in those movies.
Well, that's just an important point that Rory had just mentioned, that comics are not a genre. They're a medium. And this was the first battle, I think, really, starting in about the 80s, we had to get that point across, that comics is not just a collection of styles or types of stories. It can accommodate any style, any type of story, anything that the author might want to talk about. And that's why books like Persepolis help to really drive that home, a story about a little girl growing up in Iran during the revolution and the war with Iraq, a true story, an autobiography. That was a subject that when we were starting out, nobody thought comics were even capable of dealing with. And in fact, they were more than capable of showing us that sort of life.
Okay, and so getting back to the phrase graphic novel movement, just even in the last 10 years, there's been just a radical sea change in the perception of graphic novels, and even the sheer amount of them and the publishers that are getting involved. And I was wondering if you had any insight as to what changed, what happened that allowed this to come about.
Money.
Well, it's partially generational, too. I mean, a lot of us have been growing up. I remember speaking to people like Calvin Reed at Publishers Weekly when he had far fewer responsibilities than he does today. He was the guy running around the office saying, hey, you should look at these things, and shoving these comics into editors' faces. Well, now he's that editor. He's the guy getting other things shoved in his face. Gradually, the copy boy becomes the assistant to the editor, becomes the editor. Gradually, the guy working in the mailroom winds up, choosing content for the radio station. Gradually, the kid in at the desk in the library is the one actually choosing the collection. These things just happen gradually, because the thing with comics is that we have a disproportionately media-savvy, literate readership, and we kind of slipped in and took over. We have our moles, I guess is what I'm saying.
You said it in Understanding Comics.
Yeah.
Those exact words, I think. But the other thing that happened, besides just growing up of people in who were comic fans and acquiring some position of responsibility, why couldn't that have happened in the 40s, 50s, 60s, or 70s? Mm-hmm. I think the real sea change came from the direct market. I don't know if many of you know this. I know some of you know it very well. But the direct market was a system set up because the newsstands of America were basically all dying out. When I was a little kid walking to Rockridge Elementary, working class Italian neighborhood that it was at the time, I'd walk by four or five newsstands, depending which way I walked, and what day of the week it was when the comics came out. And you could get comics at all those places, and it was very accessible. And those things started to die out, the newsstands did. Access to comics started to shrink because comics made the unfortunate choice to stay at a dime when every other magazine was going to a quarter, 15 cents, 50 cents, and adding perhaps editorial content, advertising content. The decision was made to keep comics at a dime so they'd be affordable.
For children.
Which, again, a rather limiting audience. Nothing against comics for kids. Comics for kids are great. But comics for adults are also good. And there was this sort of myopia that was now hard to understand how they ever saw it that way, but very much how things were seen in America. We'll stay away from Kefauver, I hope. But the direct market allowed people like the Peonies and Dave Sim to start in 1977 and draw and write and produce their own comic, their own stories. And these two were very successful, others less so, and put them out there. And if you did that in a regular returnable market that would be in bookstores and newsstands, you'd have to print 20,000, 30,000, 100,000 half a million copies and put them out there and see what came back. And if what came back was 450,000 out of your half million, you were bankrupt. The direct market had a very different system. The comic book shop would order 10 copies, 5 copies, no copies. But whatever those copies totaled up to, wow, they wanted 50,000 copies of my book. You just sold 50,000 copies of your book. You didn't have 50,000 copies go out there and have 49,500 come back, or find out that you could have sold 100,000 copies of your book if you'd only made that many. It took some of the guesswork out of it for the creative audience. It also provided a center for somebody who was interested in comics, somebody who had maybe outgrown them but maybe not, to go wander in there and find a warm, accepting environment where they felt amongst their peers. And I think that helped sort of energize each other in both the direct market and the comic shop. There were certainly some negatives to comic shops. The clubhouse mentality certainly prevailed at times. But comic stores also paid their entire rent on, at the time when I first joined in 1980, by selling back issues. It wasn't by selling news stories. They were a quarter. They were 35 cents. You couldn't sell enough of those to pay your rent. But $25 back issues. Ah, I see how this works. It was a very different market. And when we got $25 book issues, it made a very different market indeed. And it allows Borders and Barnes & Noble and Amazon to play well as well, too.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay. And do you have any observations about the both the past audience for comics and the potential, what you see as the potential audience for comics?
Well, it took us some time to outgrow this notion that comics were just for children. Even as that notion prevailed in America, it was changing in Europe, it was changing in Japan. I call them the nations of comics, the three nations of comics, Europe, Japan, and North America. They all evolved in different ways. And in Europe, the notion of comics for adults really settled into the public consciousness around the 70s, the mid-70s or so. And in Japan, they had a notion of comics for everyone fairly early on. And here in America, somehow, we just persisted in this idea that comics were just for kids. And in the 80s, the traditional children's genres, like superheroes, were beginning to get a little darker, a little older, as their audiences got a little bit older. And we began to promote this idea that comics weren't just for kids anymore. Unfortunately, we woke up one day and realized that no kids were reading comics anymore, which, of course, wasn't the idea. Manga, in many ways, I think, has come to our rescue in bringing a lot of younger readers back into comics, as have North American creators like Jeff Smith, who are creating all-ages comics, comics for teens, tweens, or comics for younger readers. It's funny, a lot of factors have converged very quickly to bring back younger readers, just as we're beginning to finally appeal to adults in a much more effective way. So I think that now, you see, I'm just now realizing that I've completely forgotten your question, Andrew. What was it?
Okay, well, it was a question about the audience for comics, and what do you see as the potential for comics
to
reach an
audience? Actually, the greatest potential for the audience of comics is simply to reach every single human being on the planet. And while we'll never get there, we could get a lot closer than we've been. Right now, probably, what do you think, Rory, 1 out of 200 Americans ever cracks open a comic in the course of a year?
If you count the newspapers, maybe that high. Yeah. I don't think we're going to get close to that.
So that means there's a lot of room for growth. And we look to Japan, where there are comics about fishing and comics about cooking and comics about golf and comics about skateboarding and everything. And we say, can we do that here? Well, one of the things that's happening right now is we're beginning to see that on the web as somebody who has a goofy idea for a comic about a very, very specific subject can actually find that audience on the web directly and then come into the stores. So, for instance, a genre like comics about two guys sitting around talking about video games would have sounded preposterous just 10 years ago on the store shelves, but it's become a massive hit, a comic called Penny Arcade and other comics like it online, and because it finds its audience online, that can then bring them back into the store to get the printed version. So we're looking now and realizing, wow, there isn't any subject that you can imagine that there couldn't be a comic about. Suddenly we have comics about hardcore mathematical concepts. We have comics about PhD candidates. We have all these different genres are beginning to spring up online first frequently, but then come back into print. So so that's what's happening now is we've got kids, we've got adults, we've got more of a gender balance. Girls and boys are both reading comics at the lower ages. We're beginning to balance the ticket at the upper realm as well. Now we just want to get everyone. And I think we might actually at least partially pull it off.
We've got a better chance than we did 20 years ago. The libraries have been just one of comics' best friends. I look at it sort of almost like radio was for music sampling. Libraries often are for comic reading sampling. It takes a while to develop your own tastes, and if you're spending an awful lot of money per graphic novel to do so, that can be cost prohibitive to some people, and you can stop long before you find your killer app for comics. Player versus Player, which is PVP, which Scott mentioned earlier, was Diamond Comics, the big comic shop distribution's number one reorder book for 3 months in a row after it came out, which surprised the heck out of Diamond. Well, truth be told, surprised the heck out of me, but very pleasantly. It sold like hotcakes. But again, Calvin and Hobbes, which was free in the paper, you know, every day. When the first Calvin and Hobbes book came out, we slathered it over our window. A double shipment had come in to the local distributors. We bought it all because we love this strip. We went down the street to Bud Plant, now a mail order art dealer, but then also a comic distributor, and bought every copy they had. And one of the other comic shop owners, who was sort of bicycling up the Telegraph to see a store, asked a friend of mine, "Why does Rory have Calvin and Hobbes all over his window?" And friend Bob Borden looked at him and said, "I think he sold 100 copies this weekend." This is free in the paper. We all had read it, but people wanted that tangible copy, whether it's on the web, whether it's in the newspaper. People want to have that keepsake edition to share with other folks. Right now, not everybody in America reads. I've seen statistics as low as AP just had one that was actually very heartening to me because it said something about only 1 in 4 Americans didn't buy a book a year, but that's such a phenomenally higher number than I'd ever heard before. I heard at one point in 82 in an ABA survey, American Booksellers Association, that only 12% of Americans bought a book a year, including Harold Robbins books. And I'm sure it's good money, but I mean, I think most of America doesn't read for entertainment, doesn't read the way I read. I mean, you know, turn out that light. Sleeping bags, blankets, mm-hmm. flashlights. You know, I read by watching TV, but I was born and raised by bookworms. Most America doesn't do that, but the thing Japan has over America is a commuter culture. And to jump on the subway, to get on the train, and pick up a manga on the way in and drop in the recycle bin they have on the way out is something you can do. And if you're writing BART, you can be reading. But if I'm alongside you on the bridge and you're reading a graphic novel, I don't care if you bought it from me. I want you to stop. And unless America, and as peak oil happens, goes back more and more to a commuter rail culture, I don't know if we'll ever catch up with some parts of Europe or Japan that way. You know, the average American household watches TV for 4.5 hours. They're on the internet for a couple hours.
Though they are frequently reading on the internet.
Well, generally speaking, yeah. Or maybe even looking at pictures and reading. Ooh, comics. But again, you know, there's only a small subset of readers that really are, you know, rabid readers out there in America. Those are our first choice. That's the people we need most. Women read more than men. We need more women in comic stores. Flat out. We need more stories women want to read in comic stores. It's sort of a chicken and egg thing. And manga has brought in the tween-age girls like nobody ever would have predicted. And God bless.
Okay, and following that line of thinking, what are some trends that you've noticed recently as far as comics and graphic novels that are positive, that indicate to you that this is moving in the right direction?
Ooh, me first. American-born Chinese. Gene Yang's incredible book. First comic book ever nominated for a National Book Award. They didn't change the rules. First comic book to win a Michael Prince Award. You may not know the award, but it's the young adult librarian's equivalent to a Newbery or Caldecott medal. This is a major award. It just started up a couple years ago, I think 6 years ago. first graphic novel to ever be nominated, first one to win. Gene's also at local. He's also really nice. He'll be at our store on Sunday at this Eisner nominee awards thing. But it's a great, fun, enjoyable story that speaks from a Christian point of view, speaks from a Chinese heritage, and it speaks of being different in America. It's a great book. If you read for entertainment, you're going to like this book. Gene's a great guy. Doesn't hurt either. Scott Pilgrim. I'll let Scott answer this one because Scott's going to want to do this.
That's my favorite comic right now. I think it's the funniest comic on the planet. It's by a fellow in Halifax named Brian Lee O'Malley. And it's an interesting trend, since you're asking about the various trends in readership and the changes going on in comics right now. I think it signals a very interesting one, which is that we've had this invasion of... I shouldn't use the term invasion. We have this avalanche of manga that kids have been enjoying, and many young artists who've been inspired by manga or inspired by anime will start to do stuff that looks a lot like what they've been reading. And they may learn how to draw Japanese schoolgirl outfits and big robots and samurais and that sort of thing. But what's going on is that as they get older, they get a broader range of comics in their diet, and they're still inspired by that stuff, but they begin to metabolize it. They swallow enough of the stuff, they break it down into its nutrients, they flush out the stuff they don't want, and they develop their own voices, and that's what's been happening. And books like Scott Pilgrim by Brian Lee O'Malley, which looks kind of like manga, but isn't manga exactly. It sort of feels like it, sort of smells like it, but it isn't quite. Well, that's an example of that, because what he's doing is, even though he's informed by that stuff, he's writing about his own life. He's writing about people that he knows. It's a kind of a fantasy setting. It's like a real-life video game, the actual story. But it takes place in real locations with real people, with things that his readers recognize. And in that respect, he's bringing that revolution home to North America. Also, it's really good. A lot of the kids who are inspired by manga and anime are actually very good storytellers with a great grasp of body language and facial expressions and basic storytelling ideas. And what's cool is that O'Malley is an example of somebody who is immersed in manga and anime in the mid-90s. But right now, we have about 20 times as many kids who are reading that stuff, watching that stuff, who are interested in that, which means that in just a few years, they are going to also begin to aspire, some of them, to make comics. And they will be a generation of creators, of young creators, who will be coming ashore, so to speak, in the next few years, and they're going to be very good. They'll be 20 times the size, and a majority of them will be women. And if anything changes the face of comics, it's going to be that.
Two other books that come to mind.
I can interrupt for just a second. We've got about 5 minutes before the discussion period is over, so please start thinking about your questions. Okay, and Rory.
Two books that were in competition at the Eisner Awards this year that I thought never should have been in competition with each other, not just because I love them both, but they created a category as the judges this year for reality-based work. And so a book like Staggerly, which is this phenomenal exploration of the song and the story of Shelton Lee and Billy Lyon. You've heard the song a dozen times at least in your life, even if you don't know it. Big Mama Thornton, The Grateful Dead, Taj Mahal. I mean, everybody's done this song. And Derek McCulloch, another local, also going to be at the store on Sunday. that actually just happened to work out that way. They won 4 Lyf Awards for this book, which is the African-American Comic Award. They went back and looked at... She and Shep Hendricks, also at the store on Sunday. They went and looked at the... Hard sell. They went and looked at the songs, the variations of the songs, and used them to explore what might have been. So it's historical fiction, but historical fiction in comics. Pretty cool. It was up against and lost to a book called Fun Home. Fun Home by Alison Bechdel is one of the most poignant, including Persepolis, memoirs I've ever read. Normally when an artist starts dropping like Camus and Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man on you, you go, yeah, okay, pretension. No, this book is brilliant. This book is wonderful. This book is heartwarming. This book will break your heart. Time had it as the best book of the year. not best graphic novel, the best book of the year last year. They didn't change those rules either. So no. We're making progress. But Infun Home's a fantastic book. I mean, I think we sold 300, 400 copies of it last year. Again, just groundbreaking work. You may have known the author's work, Alison Bechtel, for her work, Dykes to Watch Out For. But again, just this is a completely different kettle of fish, very strong, very good. There'll be copies out in the lobby for you to look at during reception. Looking is always free, and there are copies at every local library.
Okay, and for the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program, and tonight we're talking with Scott McLeod and Rory Root, two icons of the comic book industry. And now let's go to the audience for questions. So we've got one in the back over there.
Hello. You keep talking about writing but and stories, but to me the most important difference between a regular short story you'd see in Anywhere magazine is the art, the pictures, the visual portrayal of the story. And I wonder if you could speak something about that.
Well, you know, it's funny because I'm usually on about the art and I forget to even mention the writing half the time. So it's funny I wound up on that side of the fence this time. It's actually the most important quality in most of the best graphic novels are the ways in which words and pictures work in tandem, where you can't really tell where one ends and the other begins, where they act as flip sides of the same coin. And this is something, this notion of the messages that pictures can convey, the content that pictures can convey, is something that I think it's only really just dawning on us now. The degree to which we tend to see words as having that capability and often neglect the fact that pictures also have that capability. I think to our peril as well, because I think in our educational system, we often fail to address the issue of visual literacy to the extent that corporations and governments can send images that fly beneath the radar in the form of images to people every day, because we really have not been trained to decode those. Comics is a medium that relies on the ability of images to transmit ideas, not simply to exist on the picture plane, not simply to exist as a form of self-expression without, you know, content. So I think it stands at that crossroads of visual literacy and visual communication.
I think somewhat also the terminology is used. One, I'm a writer simp. I'm more interested in good writing, and I think bad writing in a book will destroy it far worse than bad art will. Two, sometimes it's just shorthand. I mean, the story, the art is in service to the story, and you know, and the story is written somewhat by painting, sometimes by line drawing, not to diminish the art's importance at all, but just sort of assume them both into one storyline, and sort of makes me think of a writer, whether that writer is writer-artist or not. One of the other things about comics that it has, different than any other visual media, is it can be one person with a pencil as the full creative component of a visual story, where in movies or in TV, you end up with a pantheon of dozens, if not, you know, hundreds, you know, checking and constraining and nudging the story over here a little bit so my knees can get apart. Comics, it pretty much comes down to the writer and the artist, and sometimes they're the same person.
Frequently, increasingly frequently.
Okay, and the gentleman in the blue shirt.
I was wondering if there are any examples in the brief history of the graphic novel of screenwriters who have used it as a medium to express a potential screenplay to gather up support before taking it to a production house. If you have any examples, I would love to hear them.
I can name a couple off the top of my head that actually didn't get to the movies. One was a play. A playwright and a set designer produced one of my favorite comics of 1988 or 89 called Kings in the Skies, recently reissued by Norton. It's just a lovely, heart-wrenching, heartwarming story of the Depression era. Another, a guy named Reggie Hudlund and Aaron McGruder had written a screenplay for a movie they wanted to make, and they realized, as they say in the introduction, this is never going to happen unless Jay-Z bought Paramount. So they got Kyle Baker, a great cartoonist in his own right. And he does this stuff called The Bakers, which is wonderful, you know, family com stuff, to illustrate it. It's called Birth of a Nation. Yes, it's an intentional play off the D.W. Griffith film. It's sort of a play off the 2000 elections, and, you know, we the people, we're supposed to be represented. So, but again, funny, satirical. And many books have been done with the intent to become a movie or the intent to become the next box office smash. Mostly this tends to produce pretty bad sausage. If your intent is to do a movie, make a movie. If you want to do a TV show, do a TV show. If you want to do a comic book, do a great comic book. And if you do a great comic book, Hollywood's going to come knocking anyhow. So I don't think you need to do one to get to the other. There are numerous comic, I'm not going to name them on the radio, but there are numerous, you know, comic companies that have formed over the last several years whose obvious intent is to have that brass ring happen. God bless them. And maybe while they're doing that, one or two great books may sneak out.
Okay, and you.
Hey, so Scott, you're an artist. And Rory, you're a retailer and a writer. But what about the publishers? As someone who's considering developing a graphic novel, it's kind of confusing because it ranges from total do-it-yourself to, you know, Marvel and DC, and now with graphic novels, you have traditional publishers that are making the books. So. Comic books and graphic novels are not what I'm trained in, so it's kind of a new industry to learn. So to go out with a story and a project, in my case, it's kind of an alternative superhero action team type thing, but there's so many companies. You know, could you maybe give a range of what's out there?
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of it depends on what sort of story you want to tell. I mean, with what you've described, you'd want to look for publishers that are already interested in that sort of work, but every publisher is different, and you know the ways in which they solicit work or do not do so. You know, it varies from company to company. I'm in the business, and I couldn't tell you how to break into the business. I have no idea how this thing works. All I know is that right now the comics business is like just a moving train that never stops at the same station twice. You just sort of have to run and get on. But all you can really do is just try to create the best work you possibly can and perhaps make it available on the web so that people can see it, perhaps make it available at small press shows so that people can see it. But first comes the work. You know, I could give you a long series of steps that can lead to success, but step one will always be create a very good comic book. and that's probably enough to keep you busy for a while before you get to step two.
Going to Dark Horse.
Okay. Let's talk about that, you know, over in the party, because I think there's such a wealth of answers to this, and they vary person to person and deal the deal. You talked out at Marvel and DC as the two pinnacles. You heard of Bertelsmann Group? They own Random House. They're one of the largest publishers in the world. They've got a comics line in Pantheon, in Villard, in Del Rey. Every major New York publisher, every major Japanese publisher, every major German publisher, it's worldwide. I mean, and your resume, I agree with Scott, your best resume isn't a piece of paper with a pitch idea. Your best resume is a nice little mini comic you did off maybe on the boss's copy machine. Who says there's no free press in America? And oldies but goodies. That's your best resume. Show me the work. I can sell it. You know, you can write a book about it. Some of Europe wants to make a movie, no doubt, but show me the work. Okay. Somebody with a mic needs to be fueled.
And where's the microphone? Okay.
Big Red.
Right up here in the front row.
Hi, our daughter's starting her first job as a young adult librarian next week. What advice would you give her to help encourage potential new readers in her library?
Oh God. This is a very long answer, too.
Short version.
Read Scott's book, Understanding Comics. I say, start with pages, have her read pages 24 and 25. Mm. If she doesn't giggle or smile while reading those two pages, it's probably not her cup of tea. Talk to Francisca Goldsmith. Is she Bay Area or?
No, she'll be in Massachusetts.
Okay. Massachusetts, Boston Library System is very supportive of graphic novels. There's a Boston young adult group that meets. She should contact them. There's also something called GNLIB Topica, where 500 librarians hang out on the web and discuss what's really good and what's really bad. And this person over here wants to challenge this book. What do I do? These are resources, and every single librarian textbook, and this is such a sea change from 20 years ago, every single today's librarian, VOYA, Voices of Young Adult Librarians, Library School Journal, all of these have regular columns by graphic novel experts. I've worked with every one of these people. They're great. Find a local graphic novel guru in her area. She's in Boston, you said?
South Boston.
Go to Comicopia to have her talk to Matt Lehman.
And
Millionaire Picnic as well.
Every librarian, every expert in this field will tell you the same thing. Graphic novels circulate.
I was at
on our 50-state tour, we went up to Haines, Alaska, tiny little town of 1,000. But the library there had won the Best Small Library Award for 2006, I think it was. And they introduced graphic novels into their young readers section, and circulation went up 800%. Comics circulate.
Okay, and the young lady over there.
Hi. You guys talked earlier about how translated manga in this country really helped expand the audience for comics and also are inspiring a new generation or new generations of comics. They also seem to have helped crack open the bookstore market and make it, you know...
They are the bookstore market.
Well, yeah, but they really seem to have helped crack it open so that it's easier for publishers like Pantheon to get their books into bookstores, even though they already are in the bookstore market. I think it increased the buyer's acceptance. So aside from the variety of subject matter, do you have any insights into what the appeal of manga is? Like, why did manga take off with this whole new audience?
I'll say the unpopular answer.
Go for it.
They took a format that was decided by the Walden Books buyer for science fiction, i.e. paperback, mass market paperback. They put romance stories for teenage girls into that format. Teenage girls at that point had somewhat abandoned Harlequin and traditional romances. They put those in the malls of America. Note the Walden Books connection, not Borders and Barnes & Noble. And the teenage girls of America came out in droves and had found this wonderful new. And manga is no more a genre of teenage romance than comic books are a genre of superheroes. But that was the killer app. That's what cracked the door. That's what got them coming. And they gave it to them early and often. Those books were coming, Dark Horse, Eclipse back in the older days. A number of people had done manga stories, Viz in its earliest incarnations, had done manga stories for the direct market. They'd done science fiction, they'd done action adventure, they'd done fantastic period pieces like Lone Wolf and Cub. God bless them, great stories. Weren't flipping the 10-year-olds, hearts aflutter. Manga came out, and it came out every 3 months. And there's a reason why that on-flip format became authentic manga. It was a lot cheaper than doing the production to make it read right to left. It wasn't to do it more authentically. It was to save a lot of money and get them out there for a manga before Tokyopop, to give Tokyopop all credit, had been $17.95, $15. Manga after Tokyopop was $7.95 and $9.99. Much cheaper in the mall where mom had brought the kids in the minivan. One of the other things that I sort of touched on a little bit about all those newsstands that went away between my being a kid and now, when I was a kid, I'd hop on my bike and riding into Berkeley from North Oakland was no big deal. And my mom was the strictest mom on the block. Be home by 6. We're having dinner. Don't be late. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, a 7-year-old kid miles away from home, nobody knows where he is. It's unthinkable. I mean, this whole fear, even though we're safer now than we've ever been, barring some real tragedies, the statistics for violence and things are much better than they ever have been. But we hear about every little tragedy everywhere. So we're afeard. You know, you don't want to let your kids out of your sight, so you don't. So they don't wander down and discover that really cool bookstore down in Berkeley. You know, they don't find that really, really cool record shop that you might not be interested in. But you will take them in the minivan with some other neighborhood kids to the mall because it's your turn to do so. And while they're there, they can wander into Walden Books and find 8 bays of romance books. Awesome. And they don't even have to call them romance books. They can call it manga. And their friends know what they mean. But they're not reading romance books. Their little brothers aren't teasing him for reading romance books because he's busy reading Dragon Ball Z. So, I mean, that was the killer app that made manga. When I said manga owned the bookstores, there's a thing called BookScan. It's like Nielsen's SoundScan for records. Manga in the bookstores is 45, 48 out of the top 50 all the time. And somewhat it's a price thing, too. An American graphic novel at $20, $25 versus $7.99, you're going to sell a lot more $7.99 units. Pantheon has access, but if you walk into Stacy's down the street here, apparently the manga selection not what it could be. Or so some experts told us. But you won't find much from Pantheon there, and you'll find almost nothing from Marvel and DC. I've talked to Borders buyers telling me that they were open to buy on Sandman 2, 4, and 8. What about the other numbers? They're not in print. Sure they are. And before you think I'm picking on Borders, Diamond Comics didn't list Viz's Ranma 1/2, which is by Rumiko Takahashi. I believe she's the 7th richest woman in the world. She did it all by manga. And Ranma 1/2 was her killer app. It was the thing that just, you know, sold millions all over the world, every market. Diamond Comics Distributors, the largest American comic distributor, the only effective American comic distributor for Marvel, DC, Image, etc., listed Ranma 1/2 Volume 1 is out of print for 5 or 6 years before I finally, because I had a direct account from Viz myself. I wasn't losing any money. I was getting lots of Ranma 1s. But Viz couldn't talk Diamond into carrying it, and Diamond was convinced it was out of print. Self-fulfilling prophecy. I eventually had one of the Diamond buyers talk to one of the Viz folks, and it got back in the catalog. But it just, these kind of mistakes happen. And when you end up with really large companies that can control many, many aspects of the field, one mistake can be catastrophic for an entire line. So.
Okay, do you have anything to add, Scott?
Well, actually, going back to the original question, I didn't mean that again. It's okay. I do it all the time, Rory. I very rarely return to the question.
It's a good thing that Gabble has a short handle.
I think there is a creative difference, though. I think manga, one of the things that manga offers between the panels is the sense of involvement. And that's true whether we're talking about the girls' manga or the boys' manga. There are a fair number of successful boys' manga as well, of course. And that's that sense of involvement. And this is something that we didn't really do much in North America until fairly recently, managing to convey that sensation that you are a part of the story, that you're involved with the story, that you're not just watching it, but that you're right in the middle of the action, you're right in the middle of the emotions, you're right in the middle of the settings. And that sense of involvement and placement within the story is something that manga achieves from a variety of techniques, really a good dozen or so different techniques that are quite varied in their own way, but all somehow manage to contribute to that singular sensation of being plunked down right in the middle of it all. And that, I think, is one of the singular achievements of manga. That and the fact that they come into your head in such a very specific way by talking about things that play to individual interests and individual sensations and whatnot. So there's a creative dimension to it too, and I think that back in the early 80s when I was reading, or not reading, but looking at untranslated manga in New York when I was working in DC Comics at the production department, I was convinced that these techniques could be successful in America. What I didn't have the foresight to know was that somehow the actual manga itself could be translated, brought over here, and just really conquer the marketplace the way it did. I don't know how many people saw that coming.
The buyer of Walden Books and very few others.
Okay, I think we have time for one last question. And someone.
Thank you. Would either of you care to comment on the potential of graphic nonfiction? I think
There have been, over the last year, biographies of Ronald Reagan, Malcolm X, and I understand there's a Spain Rodriguez biography of Che Guevara coming out, in contrast to the fictional characters and heroes.
Well, Will Eisner had said he thought that nonfiction was one of the great untapped potentials of comics. I think he was right. I think it still is. I suppose that's what I've been up to the last umpteen years is nonfiction of a sort. I think that one of the important things with comics nonfiction is to have respect for the material and to have respect for the form. In the past, many nonfiction works with a specific didactic purpose have taken either a form apologizing for content approach or a content apologizing for form approach. The former being like Teen Titans Say No to Drugs sort of approach where, you know, like, let's just tell a story and have a villain and then maybe we can slip the message in when nobody's looking. And the other being when well-meaning organizations decide to issue a comic book but don't want it to be too comic booky. You really have to have faith that the material you're dealing with is interesting in and of itself and that the form, that you can use all of the tools of that form to bring it out. Now, that's in terms of nonfiction instructional, educational comics. Of course, then we have this whole other realm of biographical or autobiographical works, which are telling, which are working in a nonfictional context, but are also working in a narrative context, and that's something else again.
It's been so successful already that there have been fairly blatant attempts to co-opt it. There's been a couple lines issued of nonfiction comics designed for library use, with library use written all over them, literally, that are bad craft for the most part, that are egregiously overpriced, figuring that they only have to sell it to a library and it's not their money anyhow. Well, it's my money, actually, and it's your money, and I think we should care. But the libraries are smarter than that, and they can see these things for what they are. The reviews of this line, lines actually, have been fairly negative. But the first bookshelf you see after the art shelves and the display tables as you walk in my store, the very first shelf you run into on the right is nonfiction. And that's where Persepolis and Mouse and works of Harvey Carr, Larry Connick's Cartoon Histories are right there. And why? Because I think they're great comics. And two, I think they're accessible to a wider audience. And they will open eyes. Every year for decades now, New York Times or Spin Magazine or Playboy has ran some article saying, wow, comics aren't just for kids anymore. And people would walk in the store, and they'd walk over, and they'd pick up an Archie. They'd pick up a Batman. I'm not kidding. They'd pick up a Batman and go, just the same as it ever was. Well, yeah, it's the illusion of change. That's what that kind of episodic entertainment does. We all know continuity. We all know Superman and Lois Lane and Kryptonite, and that's great. It means anybody can pick up that toolbox and tell a story in a world we all know, even if you haven't read a Superman story in 20 years. But it's not going to be groundbreaking work, generally speaking. You're not going to be able to break those toys. You have to put them back in the toy box when you're done. And, you know, to tell your own original work, to tell some piece of history, like the Bay of Pigs, or to tell a story taken from the same source material as Band of Brothers. This is doable. This is achievable. And sometimes it's historical fiction. Sometimes it's straight nonfiction. Sometimes it's instructional. But I think manga and nonfiction have been my two main entry ways for new readership for the last 5 years.
Okay, thanks very much. Our panelists will be out in the lobby, so you can follow up with them with any questions, and Scott will be signing anything you put in front of him.
I've got a large check.
So please give a big hand to Scott and Rory.
Thank you.
And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Clubs and Forum is adjourned.